come up on a tight wire.
I'm sitting here in Studio B across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sainz.
Also in Studio B, or the arena as you like to call it.
Fighting for our lives.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Our guest today is the incomparable David Shapiro. Now, this guy's been writing poetry ever since he was 12 or 13 years old, and his first book was published at 18.
Always something of a prodigy he was. He learned to play the violin when he was about 3 or 4.
One of the things that I found interesting about David Shapiro, looking up his biography, is he was on one of the most famous photographs in Life magazine. And that was during the 1960s, when students stormed the administration building and stormed the president's office.
At
Columbia University, thank you. And he sat at the desk, behind the desk at the president's office, with a big cigar that he found there, and he lit it. And he was just sitting back with his feet on the desk, and somebody clicked a photo of that, and it ended up in Life magazine, and it made him famous.
And he later confessed that the cigar was terrible.
So anyway, we're looking forward to talking to him. Join us, and we'll be right back.
David Shapiro is an American poet, literary critic, and art historian. He is perhaps best described as the quintessential Renaissance man. His work is articulate, engaging, intellectual, serious, and always tinged with his charming humor. In addition, he is also something of an accomplished violin player. David, welcome to the show.
I was going to read you a poem about a violin and then maybe even play you.
That would be awesome.
Oh, that would be awesome. That would be awesome. You know, there will be a point at the end of the interview where we always ask, if we're interviewing a poet, we ask them to read a poem. And at that point, you can read.
Usually we ask for the ukulele, but the violin will work in this case.
I can say, this is 1717, the good violin. I wept when my father finally bought it for me. He wouldn't buy me something by this guy, Jasper Johns, whom I had met. I was 15, and I told my father to buy Jasper's work, and he said, why should I listen to a 15-year-old? Now I said to Jasper, it's my favorite thing, and he sent me an etching the other day, and I said, I don't have to become rich. The only thing you can do when you're rich is to buy a Jasper Johns. There's nothing else you can do with your money. But this is to say, I did have a great year in 1962 where I met Frank O'Hara, who wrote to me a wonderful thing about critics. He said, isn't it true that most critics just prefer another poem? He also said, I know it was hard for you to send me your poems. I hadn't known it was difficult. But once he said it, I thought, oh, he's so sweet. It's so difficult to send your poems to someone.
Were you in New York at the same time he was? I know you went to Columbia and you were there as a...
I had gone to a writer's conference that I shouldn't have gone to, where people were teasing me a lot at 15. I'd been publishing a lot, though Kenneth Koch, who was teaching, said, I love your poems. Why do you publish in such terrible magazines? I was publishing in the magazines that I'd heard of, the Antioch Review, the Minnesota Review. And he thought that was very academic. But he was very sweet, and he said, I see we both love Rilke. We love to walk out of our body. And I hadn't really known that that was what I had gotten from Rilke. And then Kenneth said, called one poem Splendid, which I loved. He introduced me to some other poets, and one of them was Allen Ginsberg was there, Frank O'Hara was there. And so by 15, I had met really standards of excellence, you might say, you know, the energy of these great poets. And I was a bit of a mascot. Frank O'Hara said, every year we kill a young poet. We call it...
That's hilarious.
Top game.
Well, I'm really enjoying your book of selected poems, and I'm amazed at January. I mean, you know, I like all the sections, but January is just an amazing poetry. And you did that when you were 18. That was published when you were 18?
It was really done when I was about 12 to 13 years old in love with
blonde
hair. I was in love with someone's blonde hair in the Allstate Orchestra. So you better believe I remember somebody saying that it was filled with desire. And, of course, it was. But, yeah, I was very young because I had trained as a violinist very young, like from age three. They put a violin in my crib. So I, in the other crib, my father was screaming Milton. Everything was done by heart, he would say. Who durst defy the omnipotent to arms? And then I started to imitate every poet that was brought to me. I learned The Wasteland, and a psychoanalyst said I couldn't be demented if I still knew The Wasteland by heart.
And could you imitate T.S. Eliot?
Fairly well, but also Ezra Pound is funnier. Years out of key with his time, he strove to resuscitate the dead art of poetry. Wrong from the start, factitious bait. And Eliot, I happen to have studied The Wasteland in a cabin recording with Robert Speight, the actor, so I know it as, but it's very close to Eliot. April is the cruelest month. Reading lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. And so my mother said, do you understand that? I was about 10, and I said, I do. And she said, you don't even know the German. But I knew how to recite it, and it took me years before I understood it. I simply loved it. I'm always amazed when people don't love T.S. Eliot. Kenneth was one of them. Kenneth Koch loved Prufrock, but thought the rest was a sort of philosophical junkyard. John Ashbery once said of Montale, isn't he the Italian T.S. Eliot? And I said, well, that wouldn't be too bad, would it?
You know, I love Eliot as well. Not so much The Wasteland as some of his other works. I really love Ash Wednesday a great deal.
I'm glad you didn't say Cats.
No.
I'm amazed that his wife has been very tough about, publishers were tough about not mentioning, for example, something painterly and his work, because Mr. Eliot didn't want his work to be illustrated. But I said, if you couldn't mention, let's say, Beckett, a painting, something else, you would annihilate 20th century criticism as I know it. But at any rate, Eliot's Confessions of Failure get to me in the four quartets.
Yes.
It's not that one loves everything, but when he really says that he has wasted 20 years of his life, that I understand. In another context, presumably he was asked whether it was all worth it, and he said, I don't think so.
Oh, that's funny.
I look at my book. This is only a 20th of what I've scribbled on paper. Now, of course, with typewriters and this terrible computer that I'm not good at, someone said the new thing is the dictaphone. Do any of you know whether it works? Because the last dictaphone that I tried years ago sounded like a schizophrene out of Dallas's darker moments.
Well, it does work, but the problem is you have to speak the punctuation, and every time you want a new line, you have to say new line, which can seriously interrupt the rhythm.
Yes. That's for our book called New Lines.
Yeah. I've started again to write my poems by hand.
It makes writing by hand very beautiful because there is a kind of intimacy that I've always felt. There are many poems I typed since age 5. I was a medical secretary because my father loved saving some money, so I knew things like diagnosis, falling in a pot of lye, prognosis, poor, ability, 90%. I was always typing, and I felt bad recently when, because of a tremor, people thought that I was a very bad speller. My brother-in-law said, how can a former Columbia professor be misspelling? But it happened.
You know, we had Mark Strand on the show, and he says that the reason why he writes a poem longhand is because if he did it on a computer or a typewriter, it looks finished before it's finished.
Finished before finished is a very good title.
You always think of titles.
When abandons things not finished, and the Jewish proverb is, it is safe to say that you will not finish the task, but it is not yours to abandon it. That's a famous rabbi.
Oh, I love that.
I know poets who are always sending me the revisions that they've made. One has gone up to 50 revisions, always telling me it's the last and the best. You have to watch out because there's, well, now I've seen The Bag in New York, I Too Like It, a revision of Marianne Moore, but by someone else. But Marianne Moore and others sometimes made the worst revisions. And
I agree.
There are some terrible revisions by Wordsworth of himself and Whitman of himself. And you know that one word, I once said that Frank O'Hara revised and Larry Rivers said, well, he only changed a word here or there. And I said, Larry, that's what we call writing.
You know, do you think Emily Dickinson revised?
Well, in one sense, she was constantly changing that musical space by her dashes and discontinuities. I think that she was more or less in a kind of mania. I happened to love and then had a dream about the poem, The Heart Asks Pleasure First, and then I said, and then for seconds. But her are easy to memorize. I've memorized thousands of them. It's like memorizing haiku. It's hard to believe that anything is better. I usually think that the pillars of the 19th century are really Whitman and Dickinson.
I agree.
And Dickinson didn't even love Whitman, which is perfect, of course.
Yes, of course it is. Let me ask you something about your interest in art, David. I have a particular interest in art as well, and I have a good friend of mine who's a poet, W.S. DePiro. He's also a very fine art critic.
Oh, right.
Yes, and I'd like to
work, and I know a painter who loves him, Paul Retzica.
Yeah, he's a wonderful poet and has a very, very keen eye for art, and he's very...
Let me tell you what happened with me. I was very lucky, though I never thought of it as luck, that my father had been bored during the Second World War by being stationed with nothing to do. He was a doctor. And someone was there from the French embassy, Bly, a neoclassicist, who happened to have worked with Rodin. And he gave my father a lump of clay, and my father did an amazing first sculpture. And I grew up with this father who believed in Bach and Beethoven, so he was mostly thinking about music all the time, not dermatology. He said he was a failure in dermatology. He was really, I've been too judgmental, says Jasper, so I won't judge him, and I actually like his work. But I grew up around kilns and heat and sculpture, so a tremendous amount of my life was feeling that I couldn't do things because my father would say to me, you don't have the occipital orb first. You must have the occipital orb. He had the language of medicine when he worked, and he could make a sculpture so quickly. So I was always surrounded by painters and others. It was a terrible moment when I saw that my father was showing a painting of mine, terrible painting, to Frank O'Hara and Larry Rivers. It was coming out of the back of a car. I had just given it was bad enough that I had given a poetry reading. But I thought, oh, my God. But they were very sweet. I was young enough. Frank O'Hara said to me, what did you like in MoMA one day? And I said, the Chelichev. And he said, why? And I knew something was wrong. I said, well, it's very bright in its colors. I was 15. And Frank said, you should have seen it before the fire. I never cared for the Chelichev again.
Do you have a favorite artist or a favorite painting?
My favorite artist is Giorgione. Giorgione said, John Ashbery, well, that's not very original. I said, well, do you want to know the truth or do you want the originality? John is so good on liking very eccentric Parmigianinos before anyone else does. But I must say that for different reasons, I find the melancholy of Jasper is the closest to what I want in poetry. And so just as Meyer Shapiro is my mentor, was my mentor for years and years, and he would still be my mentor, and his taste for Cézanne became my god, and I often say, and I'm monotheistic, but with Meyer, it's the ability to love so many different things. I think that my poetry is still that of a not-so-divine amateur, but I can't live without that ideal of the Chinese, you know, the perfections, painting, poetry, calligraphy. When I went to China, they would splash some ink and say, this is like your Jackson Pollock.
You know, as I read your poems, I wonder sometimes if you have ever use literal dreams, the dreams that you have, to enter the poetic landscape.
And years, I didn't want to say that that was true. But at 15, I had the phrase, the Cuban car door is smashed to bits. Then I started to learn how to remember my poems. And it sounds very Californian, so I don't talk about it. Almost a quarter of my poems. Fairfield Porter once said to me, how did you write this poem, Devil's Chill Sonata? And I said, well, maybe I shouldn't tell you, but a lot of it inspired by music, of course, but a lot of it is inspired by my dreams, which I can remember. And he said, oh, that accounts for its dreamy quality. And for years, I took that as a rebuke. I don't think Fairfield was rebuking me. We did a lot of work together. He taught me. I said to him, I wanted to learn how to foreshorten. And he said, well, I'll teach you tonight. I said, tonight? You'll teach me foreshortening, the secrets of foreshortening tonight? He said, yes. At night, he set me up, and he said, draw what you see. And I said, is that all? He said, draw what you see.
We're talking to David Shapiro, whose book just came out, Selected Poems, which is poems all the way from the time you were 18 to your, I guess, your last book?
Really, from 13 and 12.
13 and 12.
I'm embarrassed to put it down, but let's say there are many poems that were written when I was so young that I should be ashamed of putting them in, but it was part of me. When John Ashbery met me, he said, oh, here's the greatest 13-year-old poet, and I was so angry because I was 15, and I didn't realize that to him, 13 to 15 didn't matter that much. Now when I meet 16-year-old poets, I think that they should be fairly well-developed. It's true for the violin that one doesn't say Menuhin, one says early Menuhin, and Menuhin was quite good, but for me to mention him is a big mistake, because at a certain moment, Menuhin, my family said, we're not bad. We don't accompany you to your honeymoon like Menuhin's family. And I thought, since I was 10 when they said this, what's so bad that it's about having your mommy come to your honeymoon? But you know, the idea of the idiot savant is one thing, but I think that what Kenneth liked, he said, was, as with Rimbaud, our favorite poet, one likes the idea of learning about useful experience, which is sometimes sort of finished up for us. We have forgotten it. We've forgotten how to be a child. So for me, it was wonderful to teach my son poetry and teach him what I called the secrets of poetry, which he loved. The secrets of poetry, sworn secrets of poetry, are such things as Chekhov's use of humor and tragedy together. These are the great secrets of poetry. And using hard words and easy words together. The secrets are, of course, not secrets, but I did influence, there's a novelist, Siri, who is my student, Siri Hustvedt, and she was blocked, she said to me one day. She couldn't write poems. She was imitating some New York school poets very well, but I said to her, why don't you just pretend to be a surrealist and do nothing revision prone, just write for about a day or two. She did, and she didn't look back. She's written about 6 novels that she accredits from Professor X. I am Professor X.
Do you think that art is doing the same thing as poetry?
Yes. It's my determined view on this show, where we don't have hundreds of years to elaborate, but it's my determined view that poetry is architecture, architecture is poetry, and the great architect, John Haydock, believed this with me, so he made the crazy strategy of bringing me to teach architects. And our idea was architecture would not be greed, zoning laws, etc., but it would be a place where architects could think about how to make architecture in the condition of cubism, how to make architecture in the condition of Vasily Kandinsky. And there's no doubt that the great schools, like the Black Mountain School, but one thinks primarily of my old friend John Cage. He was told that he had to concentrate on one thing, and it was very hard to do anything about one thing except music. But we just saw his watercolors, and they're heartbreaking. They're so beautiful. And his ideal brushes, which he made for himself out of feathers. And John is an example of a man who said that he believed that one should dedicate oneself to one thing, but on the other hand, he dedicated himself to everything, to ballet, to dance, to... So my preference in thinking about things is like Jakobson's sense. I had met him. Jakobson believed that everything was structure, and that was a very beautiful insight. It can become academic, and certainly some people can make terrible paintings. I'm one of them.
My
wife, when she met me, would say of a red nude that I had done, "Why don't you reconsider the top corner?" I reconsidered it. She then said, "Why don't you reconsider the other half of it?" Finally, I said, "You don't like this painting." And she didn't. And after about 40 years, I threw it out. I decided she was right, and I got rid of it. But you have to be very careful. A madman said to me, "If you can, save everything. It'll be useful for you in a Jungian way." I didn't know Jung. I was 10. So I'm useful for libraries now because I've saved, not that I've given them away, but I've saved thousands of letters that in those days were handwritten by Marion Moore or handwritten by Frank O'Hara.
Who are some of your favorite contemporary American poets?
Keats. Someone said, I said Stevenson. Richard Castellanos is a well-known avant-gardist. And I said, Stevens is my favorite living poet. And he said, he's dead. And I said, not for me. So for a long time, I would have answered that, Stevens. And there is an encyclopedia that has a chapter called Our Dead Contemporaries. That's really terrible. But there is the sense in which if you play Schubert's Quintet in C, as I did at my mother's own funeral, you don't get a sense that it's aged or is certain number of years. I mean, it's true teaching. I teach that Picasso was born in 1881 and died in 1973 or whatever. And it is important sometimes, as I tell my kids, to know when Les Demoiselles d'Avignon was done, because you can be dazzled by the relationships between Cubist works. But for me, a lot of the great masters are gone. So today, for example, I said to someone, I would still be shocked if Godard walked through my door. But I've gotten to the point where I like what Godard said about himself. Someone said, your work is often called too difficult. And he said, yes, yes, but what about your hamburgers? Your hamburgers are not so good. Then said in a poem or a place, he said, I am a man, only a man. I am no better than other men, and no man is better than me. I like the idea of a democracy in one sense. It's great to know how to praise one's contemporaries. And then Frank O'Hara said, they are also useful thorns in one's side. But I'm philosophically a pluralist. I love many different kinds of paintings, both realistic and abstract. I've been trained to be a pluralist by a great pluralist, Meyer Shapiro. I asked Bill de Kooning once, is it true, the story that Meyer Shapiro saved your woman number one, that my teacher Meyer came over and talked about? He said, yes, tell him to come again. That man tells you that what you do, you should be doing, not like the other guys who tell you not to do what you're doing. Tell him to come again. Tell him to come again. We need very often positive criticism. I can be very tough on myself, and I know the great revisions that made things so amazing. But still in all, if you ask me who I learned from the most, it's probably Proust and Kafka. Proust on the side of the starless chaos of the social, and Kafka on the starless side of the interior. I mean, if God doesn't include Kafka and Proust, then I'm not in the religion.
David, you've been a charming guest, and I'd ask you to now read your violin poem and play your violin for us. It would be a real pleasure.
Here's a little poem about a violin, but before I do it, I'll play you the violin that I'm talking about. Unfortunately, I'm out of shape, so I'm only going to play you a little bit that I played at my bar mitzvah. It's better when I was 13. Thank you. grungy version of something that teaches us, again, what you learn from. My grandfather, the greatest Jewish singer, you can get him on the computer under Chagy, and he would go to the Apollo Theater with Achron, the composer of that piece, and they would learn. He said he learned from the Persian hour. He learned and he learned, and it was all this joy of different kinds of music. And now I'll read you a poem that was inspired, though someone said, I often say things, who cares what inspired it? But what inspired it was fairy tales of the Russian kind. The Russians often say it was and it was not. And so this is a poem, Falling Upwards. A certain violinist had a beautiful violin, but before he had had time to play her long and listen to her tones as such, he was compelled to renounce music and sell her and go on a far journey and leave his violin in the hands of the violin case. What was there to do? It is said, you cannot live life in quarter tones. What was there to do? It is said, you cannot live your life in silence. What was there to do? It is said, you cannot live your life playing scales. What was there to do? It is said, you cannot live your life listening to the Americans. What was there to do? It is said, you cannot live your life in your room and not go out. What was there to do? It is said, music disobeys and reaches the prince's courtyard ever farther than smell and grits its notes like teeth and gives us food and drink and orders a fire to be lighted, famished silk to hang over it, and repetition to be sharpened. What was there to do? It is said, it is the violinists who do not sleep. What was there to do? It is said, we think and don't think. We are asleep. What was there to do? It is said, music sinks into the mire, up to its neck, wants to crawl out but cannot. What was there to do? It is said, the violin was a swan, seized the boy, falling upwards to some height above the earth. That's the end of that poem, and I thank you.
Thank you for being on our show, David Shapiro. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, David Shapiro, for appearing on our show today. And thanks for listening in on another edition of Words on a Wire.
And make sure you join us next week when we have one of my favorite new poets. I say new because he's only on his second book, Matthew Dickman.
Who is a twin, and his brother is also a poet.
Yes, and we're going to have Matthew on the show. We'll see you next week. I'm Daniel Chacon.
I'm Benjamin Alita Sines.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life. I'm up on a tight wire.